VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, John Russell tells us about a new show of paintings by the famous Dutch artist Johannes Vermeer. Faith Perlow and Katie Weaver present a new everyday grammar lesson. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is John Russell.
The National Museum of the Netherlands is holding the largest show ever of paintings by Dutch artist Johannes Vermeer. The Rijksmuseum is in the capital, Amsterdam. It has placed 28 paintings on exhibit. It says they represent about half of the 17th century artist's body of work. Vermeer is known for his expertise at representing light in his paintings. His subject was often common household objects. The artist worked slowly on his paintings and died at the age of 43. He likely never saw so many of his own works together at one time. Rijksmuseum director Taco Dibbets said Vermeer had a large family and busy life as an art dealer. Still, he said, the painter was able to create works of quiet beauty. It's this complete focus and tranquility in his paintings that we still love today, Dibbets said. The show includes some of Vermeer's most famous works, including Girl with a Pearl Earring, 1664, and The Milkmaid, 1659. Visitors can also see his two known outdoor paintings and several others of women playing instruments, reading, and working. "We're really coming closer to Vermeer than we've ever been," said Peter Roelofs, the Rijksmuseum's head of paintings and sculpture. "What is striking about Vermeer," Roelofs said, "is that in his paintings, it's mostly women who are the protagonists, meaning the main subjects." The expert noted that Vermeer had 7 daughters. Roelofs said Vermeer's works are more than something a good eye and skilled hand can create. Recent examinations show The Milkmaid was repainted several times. Writer Tracy Chevalier attended an event for the show before it opened. She wrote the popular book Girl with a Pearl Earring, a historical fiction based on the painting. It later became a movie. Chevalier said the show presents Vermeer as a quiet and private man. "His paintings are so quiet and there are no children. He must have compartmentalized his life and said, 'No, no kids in the studio.'" Museums in Germany, France, Japan, Britain, Ireland, and the United States helped with the public showing, which opens on Friday and runs until June. I'm John Russell.
Recently, we discussed traditional stories called fairy tales. These stories are passed down through the generations. We learned that these tales take place at an inexact time in the past, once upon a time, or long ago. They include wonderful characters and magical elements, like special numbers and talking animals. But that was just the start to these special stories. In today's Everyday Grammar, we will consider how fairy tales end. We also will talk about the setting, the action of the story, and the life lessons a reader might learn.
The setting of a story answers questions about where it takes place. Since most fairy tales are very old stories, they take place in settings like forests, castles, villages, small countryside houses, or farms. Readers need to create a picture of these places in their minds. Fairy tales use adjectives to describe the wondrous settings. Let's look at a few examples. In the fairy tale Puss in Boots, the hero is a cat, which wears boots, that enters the stately castle of an ogre. There, the cat tricks the giant creature into turning himself into a mouse, which the cat immediately eats. In the castle, there are spacious halls, which the cat will later walk through with the king. The adjective stately means something that is impressive in appearance, behavior, or size. Spacious is another adjective meaning wide, open, and with a lot of room or space. The use of special adjectives in fairy tales is meant to paint a picture in the mind that makes the story come to life.
In the Grimm Brothers' telling of Snow White, the opening setting helps describe something else, Snow White herself. White snow was falling, and the cruel queen was sitting by a window, surrounded by black material. She stuck her finger with her sewing needle, creating red drops of blood. The queen asked for a child with these colors: pale or snow-white skin, black hair, and rosy red cheeks and lips. In this telling, the setting creates a magical picture of our main character, even before she appears in the story. Let's move on to actions in the fairy tales. A hero or heroine might meet other important characters, fight an evil villain, complete a magical task or adventure, or do something three times. There are many possibilities. The action of the story answers the question, what is happening? It describes the events or plot of the story. We can look at the verbs and adverbs in the fairy tale to see how the plot develops and where the conflict comes in. Here is an example from The Snow Maiden. She grew very rapidly, not only daily, but hourly, into a tall, beautiful, and graceful girl. We see that the writer uses grew as the verb, and rapidly, daily, and hourly, to intensify the reader's understanding of the Snow Maiden's growth. After a time, spring comes, and so does conflict. Because the weather is warm, the Snow Maiden is sad, and she does not want to play with her friends in the forest. After a while, she finally agrees, but something happens. As the Snow Maiden was jumping over the flames After her companions, she evaporated into a thin cloud. Here, we see the phrasal verb to jump over in the past progressive form. And we see the verb evaporate, which is a highly descriptive verb meaning to disappear into nothing. And this brings us to lessons and closings.
Not all fairy tales teach morals or lessons for our daily lives, but many do. Fables are such stories. They often use animals that behave like humans to teach lessons about life. These tales often end with a moral. For example, in The Town Mouse and the Country Mouse, the country mouse visits his cousin, the town mouse. In the busy town, their fancy dinner is interrupted by two large dogs. The moral of the story is, it is better to live in peace and quiet and have a simple life than to live in fear surrounded by comfortable objects. The final words in many fairy tales are well known. After the hero or heroine succeeds, or there is a marriage, they all lived happily ever after. This phrase provides a summary to finish the story and leave readers with good thoughts. We often expect happy endings to many of our stories, not just fairy tales. Although many fairy tales do end this way, others might not. For example, The Snow Maiden ends sadly for the old husband and wife who wanted a child. The Snow Maiden evaporates while jumping over a fire.
Today, we talked about fairy tale endings, which do not always end happily ever after. We answered the question of where when we talked about settings. We learned how adjectives can describe those places. We also considered the actions and plots of some fairy tales. By using verbs and adverbs, writers develop stories or create interesting conflict. And we gave some thought to the morals or lessons of the tales, especially with fables. Let's close with some homework. Do you remember the fairy tale you chose a few weeks ago? Answer the following questions. Where does the fairy tale take place? What verbs and adverbs are used to talk about the action or plot of the tale? Is there a moral or lesson? What is it? After that, consider, how does the fairy tale end? Is there a happily ever after ending? Or is it sad? Send your answers to learningenglish@voanews.com. Share your work in the comments below. I'm Faith Perlow.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Just heard Faith Perlow and Katie Weaver present this week's Everyday Grammar Report. Faith joins me now to talk more about the lesson. Hi, Faith. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Ashley. It's great to be back.
This week, you followed up on your report from last month about fairy tales. You noted that some fairy tales include a moral. Can you talk with us today more about that word? Doesn't it mean something good and acceptable?
Of course. You're correct. The word moral in the plural form is morals. Morals are someone's standards of what is right and wrong. For example, if you have good morals, you are a good person.
And what does the singular version mean, which you used in this week's lesson?
A moral is a lesson at the end of a story about how someone should or should not behave, or how society should be. So it's something you learn from the story. It's closely related to morals, like what is right or wrong. Stories that have clear morals at the end are called fables. Fairy tales sometimes have morals, but they are often not so obvious, and we have to think about what the lesson is.
Thanks for sharing that, and thanks for being here today.
You're welcome, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you the story of the Statue of Liberty. It was given to the United States by the people of France. Lady Liberty holds a bright torch high over the harbor of New York City. Millions of immigrants coming to America passed the statue as ships carried them to the Immigration Processing Center on Ellis Island. Leo Scully and Morris Joyce tell the story of immigration in the United States during the 1800s.
American life was changing, and it was changing quickly. Before 1860, the United States had an agricultural economy. After 1860, the country began to change from an agricultural to an industrial economy. In 1860, American shops and factories produced less than $2,000 million worth of goods. 30 years later, in 1890, American factories produced $10,000 million worth. By then, more than 5 million persons were working in factories and mines. Another 3 million had jobs in the building industries and transportation.
Year after year, production continued to increase, and the size of the industrial labor force continued to grow. A great many of the new industrial workers came from American farms. Farm work was hard, and the pay was low. Young men left the family farms as soon as they could. They went to towns and cities to look for an easier and better way of life. Many of them found it in the factories. A young man who worked hard and learned new skills could rise quickly to better and better jobs. This was not only true for farmers, but also for immigrants who came to the United States from foreign countries. They came from many different lands and for many different reasons, but all came with the same hope for a better life in a new world.
In the 1850s, America's Industrial Revolution was just beginning. Factories needed skilled workers, men who knew how to do all the necessary jobs. Factory owners offered high pay to workers who had these skills. British workers had them. Many had spent years in British factories. Pay was poor in Britain, and these skilled workers could get much more money in America. So many of them came, hundreds of thousands. Some factories, even some industries, seemed completely British.
Cloth factories in Falls River, Massachusetts, were filled with young men from Lancashire, England. Most of the workers in the shipyards of San Francisco were from Scotland. Many of the coal miners in America were men from the British mines in Wales. Many were farmers who came to America because they could get land for nothing. They could build new farms for themselves in the rich land of the American West.
One of the best liked songs in Britain then was a song about the better life in America. Its name, To the West. Its words helped many men decide to make the move to America. To the West, to the land of the free, where mighty Missouri rolls down to the sea, where a man is a man if he's willing to toil, and the poorest may harvest the fruits of the soil, where the young may exult and the aged may rest, away, far away, to the land of the West.
To another group of immigrants, America was the last hope. Ireland in the 1840s suffered one crop failure after another. Hungry men had to leave. In 1850 alone, more than 117,000 people came to the United States from Ireland. Most had no money and little education. To those men and women, America was a magic name.
Throughout Europe, when times were hard, people talked of going to America. In some countries, organizations were formed to help people emigrate to the United States. A Polish farmer wrote to such an organization in Warsaw. I want to go to America, but I have no money. I have nothing but the 10 fingers of my hands, a wife, and 9 children. I have no work at all, although I am strong and healthy and only 45 years old. I have been to many towns and cities in Poland, wherever I could go. Nowhere could I earn much money. I wish to work, but what can I do? I will not steal, and I have no work. So I beg you to accept me for a journey to America.
As the years passed, fewer people were moving to America for a better job. Most were coming now for any job at all. Work was hard to find in any of the cities in Europe. A British lawmaker told Parliament in 1870 that Englishmen were leaving their country not because they wanted to, but because they had to. They could not find work at home. He said that even as he spoke, hundreds were dying of hunger in London and other British cities. They were victims of the new revolution in agriculture and industry. Small family farms were disappearing. In their places rose large modern farms that could produce much more. New machines took the place of men, and millions of farmers had to look for other work. Some found it in the factories. Industry was growing quickly, but not quickly enough to give jobs to all the farmers out of work.
In the next 10 years, millions of people made the move from Britain, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. But then, as industry in those countries grew larger and more jobs opened, the flood of immigration began to slow. The immigrants now were coming from southern and eastern Europe. Anti-Jewish feeling swept Russia and Poland. Violence against Jews caused many of them to move to America. In the late 1880s, cholera spread through much of southern Italy. Fear of the disease led many families to leave for the United States. Others left when their governments began building up strong armies. Young men who did not want to be soldiers often escaped by moving to America. Big armies were costly, and many people left because they did not want to pay the high taxes. Whatever the reason, people continued to immigrate to the United States.
These new immigrants were not like those who came earlier. These new immigrants had no skills. Most were unable to read or write. Factory owners found that these Eastern and Southern Europeans were hard workers. They did not protest because the work was hard and the pay was low. They did not demand better working conditions. They did not join unions or strike. Factory owners began to replace higher-paid American and British workers with the new immigrants. Business leaders wanted more of the new workers. They urged the immigrants to write letters to their friends and relatives in the old country. Tell them to come to America, that there are plenty of jobs.
Letters from America brought many more immigrants. The big steamship companies also helped industry to get more of the new workers. They paid thousands of agents throughout Europe to sell tickets for the trip to America. Their efforts meant that steamships bringing grain to Europe could return to America filled with immigrants. They came by the hundreds of thousands, people of all religions from all across Europe. Many remained in New York and other eastern cities, but many others moved westward. They took jobs in the steel factories of Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and meat packing plants of Chicago.
Within a few years, foreign-born workers held most of the unskilled jobs in many American industries. American workers began to protest. They demanded an end to the flood of immigration. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm